From Charter Hall and Banish, this is Sustainability Further. I'm your host, Lottie DL. You're listening to Sustainability Further, a podcast by Charter Hall. One of Australia's leading property groups, Charter Hall is focused on creating innovative spaces and going further to build a better future for all. In this episode, we speak with Professor Mark Howden, Director of the ANU Institute for Climate, Energy and Disaster Solutions and Vice Chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC. He has been a major contributor to the IPCC since 1991, with roles in the second, third, fourth, fifth, and now sixth assessment reports, sharing the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with other IPCC participants and Al Gore himself. He's also co-authored over 430 publications. So without further ado, let's get into it. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, Mark. I wanted to first of all start with asking you, what does the word sustainability mean to you?
Look, it's actually a really complex sort of set of concepts that are there, and different people have different takes. But for me, it's actually pretty simple. It is essentially making decisions that leave our world in an overall better state for future generations.
I love it. Keep it simple. And I think it is about, I love the key word in that phrase that you've just mentioned, better. Not the way that we found it, but better than we found it.
That's right. And also for me, overall is important because you can have trade-offs. You know, you can improve, you know, some aspects of sustainability, but at the cost of others. And so we sort of need to recognize that there is an overall element. We're trying for an aggregate improvement here.
No, definitely. And so you are the vice chair of the IPCC. So you are at the center of the reports that so many people devour. The most recent report was probably one of the most alarming, and it was pretty much suggesting that we may not get a hold on global temperatures of a 1.5 degree change. We might actually overshoot this. So what does this actually mean for our future?
Well, in a sense, your comment about it being alarming is simply reflects the fact that climate change is ongoing and it's actually accelerating in many different respects. And so it's not surprising that progressive IPCC reports actually have more concerning things to say. And in fact, that's one of the conclusions I draw from IPCC is essentially that the more we know, the more reasons there are for our concerns about climate change. But when we look at overshoot, that's essentially where we have a temporary exceedance of, in this case, 1.5 degrees. So that overshoot might be small and short, or it might be much bigger and longer. You know, so instead of 1.5, we might go to 1.6 and then drop back down, would be a limited overshoot. But maybe going up to, say, 1.8 degrees and then coming down slowly would be a longer and bigger overshoot. And in each case, we're likely to experience significantly more severe impacts of climate change than if we manage to keep temperatures down to 1.5 degrees. And those impacts are likely to be assessed and found in every different sector across our globe. And some of those impacts could effectively be irreversible, such as, you know, extinction of species. So there is a very significant reason why we should be concerned about overshoot and keep it down as low as possible.
Yeah, I think it is. You're right. We are learning, and we're all, especially in kind of your field, we're finding out so much more than we actually did a couple of years ago. And I feel like each and every week there is, we're armed with more information, which is an amazing thing. And it's also great, but it is also, as I just said before, quite alarming. So you helped develop both the national and international greenhouse inventories, which are a fundamental part of the Paris Agreement, and you've assessed ways to reduce emissions. What are the major changes that we're likely to see in the next 5 years?
I think those changes are going to be pretty significant, possibly not as fast as a lot of people would like, but nevertheless quite significant. So I think we're going to see a major rollout of renewable energy right across the globe. So this is essentially renewable electricity, if you want to think of it like that. And that's going to translate to changes in other sectors, such as electric vehicles and changes in industrial processes. And importantly, I think we'll see through that a lot of increased opportunities for low emissions industry. And because of those opportunities, we'll be able to turn the narrative around from climate change action being a cost to climate change action being an opportunity, something we can't afford not to do. And as part of that, I think we'll see changes in other sectors. So people eating more healthy foods, lower emissions diets. And part of that will be from choices that we make. So, you know, changing our dietary mix, but also changes in the food value chain. So finding ways to produce the food that we eat with much lower greenhouse gas footprints. And I think there'll be a whole series of new products in food and elsewhere. And so that will give us new choices. And I think really importantly, we'll see an overall increase in the focus on sustainability measures and standards, sort of standards that are getting applied by investors, by banks, by insurance companies to actually perform much more effectively in terms of climate change. And similarly, there'll be standards which we impose on governments to do a lot better in terms of climate change and in terms of the environment overall.
I think that's a really interesting point that you're raising there about the kind of the standards and putting the onuses on organizations and on governments. And it's something that because no one's really exactly sure what's going on. This is a very new kind of approach to business in a way. So it's going to be a really interesting time, I think, to see what happens in the next couple of years. Are there any examples within Australia of organizations that are doing this really well?
So there's progress in all sorts of different sectors, but one of the ones which I find really interesting is in terms of our buildings. So if we look at our buildings generally, Australia isn't doing very well. Our buildings tend to be very greenhouse gas intensive in their construction and very greenhouse gas intensive in their operations. And also they are often not particularly well designed for our extreme climate. They don't deal with cold weather or very hot weather very well. And so generally speaking, we're not doing a great job of that. But there are some buildings which do a really great job of that. So they're particularly those which are associated with passive house standards. So passive houses where you get really well insulated buildings with a very strong building envelope. So you get very little leakage of energy and air in and out of the building, but they're at the same time very well ventilated. So they're very healthy buildings. And these passive house buildings can be built very effectively with relatively low greenhouse gas footprints. They can operate with almost zero or negative greenhouse gas footprints because you put a bunch of solar panels and you more than supply the needs for heating and cooling for those houses. And they also increase the asset value of the house. So people really want to live in these houses. So that's an example of how we are starting to make progress. But at the moment, there's only a handful of these buildings built every year. We need to roll that out so it's the majority of buildings meet these sorts of standards.
Passive housing, that's a one to add to my dictionary. I'm learning something new today. But no, you're right. It's one of these things as well. I think people are scared about change and they're scared about trying something new, which is probably why they haven't heard about the passive houses or they haven't really given it a bit of a try because it is a bit scary and daunting. So hopefully we do start to see it being rolled out more and more. So you're on the ACT Climate Council, which helps advise the ACT government. So we've seen some remarkable things coming from that government, especially on pushing down greenhouse gas emissions. So what are some of the key learnings that you think other governments and businesses can also take from this?
Well, I think one of the first things to take is that being strategic and being proactive really pays. So if we look at, say, the movement to renewable electricity in the ACT, there's really significant first mover benefits that the ACT government were able to accrue by being the first out into the market for renewable energy contracts. And so that's been, I think, a really important thing. Similarly, there's this realization in the ACT is that it's much better to be proactive and change the things from here on in rather than to be reactive, because that means you always have to be retrofitting more and more infrastructure, more and more roads, etc. And retrofitting is really expensive when it comes to improving energy and greenhouse gas performance. I think the ACT also was really strong in terms of thinking strategically. So putting in place that big first element, which is renewable electricity, then allows them to electrify the whole of the system. So essentially with renewable and low emissions energy. So it means you could move into the public transport and, you know, the electric trams are all renewable. Electric buses, all renewable. Heating in the houses, if it's heat pumped, all renewable, zero emissions. So by thinking in terms of the really building blocks of how to actually get change, they've been very strategic. And important to say, though, that the renewable electricity transition is the easy part of the transition in a sense. It's relatively straightforward technology. It's relatively positive in terms of benefits. So people in the ACT pay much less for our electricity than people adjacent to us, say, in New South Wales, because of the proactive nature of what the ACT government has done. But then there's a whole stack of harder to abate sectors, such as heating of houses, you know, moving from gas to electricity, transport, moving from petrol-driven cars to electric vehicles, and the waste sector, et cetera. So there's some bits of which are easy, but then there's a whole stack of really difficult things to do, which start to become a lot more messy and about individual decision-making rather than governmental decision-making.
I think that point that you've raised there about kind of being proactive, not reactive, is so smart. And it sounds so easy, and it sounds easier said than done. But for a government to actually stick with that approach and to really forward plan and forward think is something that I think we need to be seeing across the rest of the nation and also the globe. A big theme that comes through on this podcast is a lot about collaboration and different organizations and businesses and governments and individuals working together, which I think that when we look at the findings of the IPCC is something that we all need to really do to limit the effects of climate change. So what are some ways that people can work across these different organizational levels to reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, firstly, I think it's being aware of the implications of our activities. So whether it's greenhouse gas emissions or the environmental implications more broadly or the social implications. So being aware and informed, I think, is the very first step. Then I think we need to start to actually have a plan of action. So it's, you know, for individuals or families that may be just in terms of reducing our overall consumption and documenting what our overall consumption and footprint is. Then I think there's a role for collaborative arrangements that provide the information that people can use to enable better choices for better options, such as lower emission options, ones with, you know, broader, lower environmental footprint, ones which don't have social problems associated with them. So, you know, sweatshop type products and things where you know, essentially modern slavery is used. And so we need to be thinking about how we have information streams that are robust and reliable that enable those choices to be made at reasonable cost. So we don't want them to be the purview of the elites. We actually want them to be accessible to most people. And I think there's also a role in terms of making sure that when we do come up collectively with solutions, that they do approach things in a comprehensive way. So that means when we take action on climate change, we're also bringing co-benefits in other respects. So one example of this would be, you know, shifting from coal-fired power stations to renewables increases the number of jobs, increases in the sense the quality of some of those jobs. It reduces air pollution very significantly, almost completely, and in the process reduces mortality and illness of people from that air pollution, both in the location of mining and the location of combustion. It also can have other benefits, such as reduced water consumption or reduced temperatures in our streams. Sometimes big thermal power plants can push up stream temperatures beyond environmental limits. So by thinking about, you know, alternative approaches, we can often come up with really significant co-benefits that justify, I think, even more rapid transitions and more complete transitions than we otherwise would.
Yeah, it's great. And I think one of the things there that you've just spoken about, it kind of relates to information is key. Information and data around everything. If it is these kind of these co-benefits, it's being able to translate that and to speak about it with the right people and these decision makers to be able to give them not only one benefit being the environmental benefits, but also the economic or the health or the social benefits as well. So in your opinion, I would love to kind of, I love learning about technological innovation and all of these things that are happening that kind of are absolutely blowing my mind that nobody really knows about yet. But I'm sure that you are somebody that is surrounded by this each and every day. So what are some of the most promising technological innovations that could contribute to a sustainable future? And how can we make sure that all of these innovations are accessible to all?
When I look around, I see pretty much every sector has innovations that could make a big difference. So whether we're looking at our energy systems, we've obviously got renewables out there, but we've only just started the journey to actually have a renewable energy society. And so there's lots and lots of improvements that we can make in terms of battery technology, in terms of system integration and things like that. So we're going to see a lot more of that in the energy sector. And similarly, people are pretty aware of the prospects for electric vehicles. There's just a price barrier. Some people are a bit have range anxiety as well. But as a second EV owner, I've actually never had a problem with range. That range anxiety just has never been part of it. It's always been manageable. And so there's so much cleaner, cheaper, smoother, faster acceleration. They're fun to drive. You can have guilt-free driving, and so you don't have to, stress about the greenhouse emissions from driving up to Sydney because it's all done renewably with our electricity from the ACT. One of the things that people tend to think about less is innovations in our food system. So there's approaches which perhaps might seem a bit science fiction at the moment, but I think will become much more common in the future about using alternative food production systems. So people are pretty used these days to have plant-based meat alternatives and plant-based milk alternatives, and that's fairly straightforward stuff. But there's other things which are coming on board. So there's a whole series of technologies which are about vat-grown meat, so using actual meat cells to effectively grow a steak in a Petri dish. Personally, I'm not particularly into that, but there are other technologies which aren't spoken about so much, and that's effectively using yeast cellular system, so it's not a meat-type product. And you can use these what's called bioreactors, and you can hook them up to, say, a hectare mostly of solar panels producing electricity and maybe a wind generator as well. And you can use some of that electricity to capture carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and then you can use that carbon dioxide as part of the feedstock into one of these systems, and you can actually start to generate protein and carbohydrates using the yeast as your organism. And there's some calculations done which actually indicate that a hectare of these sorts of systems could produce around about 10 times as much carbohydrate per hectare as our current cropping systems, and about twice as much protein per hectare as our current cropping systems or livestock systems can do. So, this is about thinking about how do we then get these sorts of products into the value chain in a way that's acceptable to people so that they don't see this as a sci-fi problematic food stuff, but something which is actually really modern, clean and versatile. So for me, there's some really interesting things which are on the sort of horizon, which will take us out of our current comfort zone and into a new place.
I've never heard about that before. What is the kind of, is it a yeast system? What would you call that kind of, is it just called the yeast system? Did I just name it?
Oh, it's essentially just a microbial system, and it's just using, small organisms like yeasts to actually produce foodstuffs. And so we use yeasts a lot already. We use them in bread making and beer making and similar things. They're a sort of a well-known organism which we're able to select for different properties, different taste and smell profiles, different characteristics of the sugars or the alcohols they produce, etc. So it's not such a big jump to actually think that we can do these sorts of things. And they're already acceptable. We already eat bread and we already drink beer and stuff like that.
No, I think it's a lot more palatable to say that you're going to make something from yeast rather than from a tortoise or from crickets or something like that. It's going to be something that is more socially acceptable because, as you say, we're all lovers of beer and bread. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It has been so interesting and I have learned so much, and I'm sure all of our listeners have as well.
Thanks, Lottie. It's been great.
This conversation is
part of Charter Hall and Vanish's podcast series, Sustainability Further. This series has been designed to inspire Australians to be more environmentally responsible and to take climate action. Sustainability Further is produced by Vanish. Charter Hall's purpose is to create better futures by bringing aspirations to life.